We will convene the Public Safety Regime Subcommittee, continue our hearings on this Tuesday, April 13th, regarding Senate Bill 6517, the Judicial Department.
Are we rolling officially?
Perfect. Sometimes I get ahead of myself. Do we have any comments from staff?
No comments today.
Let us deviate just a little bit from our printed schedule. I'd like to call Arnie Green up and Commissioner Rick Holt. Gentlemen, you have 5 minutes. I'd also like, for the record, to indicate that you noticed who was sitting in the chair's position and who just sat herself at the dais.
Melinda? Okay.
We have a running deal going there. No, it's okay. Anyway, gentlemen, sign in, please. 5 minutes and 30.
Thank you, sir. My name is Rick Holt, Jackson County Board of Commissioners, Chair of the Board. I'm just here in full support of the bill that's before you. We need judges in Jackson County. If we were to go by the Gleans Commission report, we'd have or be capable of having 10.7 judges. Our workload on our judges is intensifying day to day. It's overwhelming. We have some statistical support that will be documents that we'll be submitting for the record. The mental health portion of this is extremely important to us. And with that, I won't get into the other three pages I have here because we are limited and this gentleman has some real important work. Thank you.
Yeah, we are behind schedule. I appreciate you coming up and going on the record because all support we can get is appreciated.
Thank you.
Arnie?
My name is Arnie Green from Jackson County. I'm the Executive Director of Community Works, which is a social service agency down in Jackson County, and just wanted to lend my support to the issue. The most exciting thing that's happening in the state, as far as I can tell, in Jackson and Deschutes County with the family law program that we just started in Jackson County. Jackson County is also doing some very exciting things in integrated social services, and our work with the family court has allowed us to have clout with some families that we've never had before, and it's allowed us to do some work with families in need that we've never been able to do before. And I just can't tell you what a difference it makes. And this is going to be one of those changes that, as we look back on it, 10, 15, 20 years from now, will be one of the largest changes that has happened in Oregon for kids and families in trouble. So, lend my support to more judges and more family courts.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, they're okay, dynamic, scintillating, vibrant.
It's exciting.
It's really. Any questions for Mr. Green or Commissioner Holt?
Gentlemen, thank you
very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I did have a couple of my witnesses, expert witnesses that had traveled a great distance, translate honorary pages that we were going to intimidate and harass at the witness stand, but seeing as how they obviously aren't in attendance, we'll have to make do with Kingsley Click and Carl to intimidate and harass. So if the technology people would come up for their brief presentation.
For the record, Mr. Chair, Kingsley Click, Secret Administrator, and we will offer up some sacrificial victims later in the agenda from afar. Well, we left yesterday. There were two items that we wanted to cover today and then open to the committee questions. One was the impact of the integrated justice environment in the trial courts and why it is a critical component. It was the blue sheet that we were looking at, the community benefit that yet. Jim has that.
In your blue technology package to each report.
And then the other thing will be to take you back to the graph that we visited yesterday of growth and budget with a added information.
Thank you. Okay. Hold on, we're in a state of complete and total disarray up here. Senator Kim just admitted that it's his fault.
It should be in the official binder.
Well, that's fine. Yeah.
It's probably in the binder on the bottom, Senator.
It's on the bottom.
I do.
No, it says technology.
I do.
Oh, the little purple. Technology partnership or just technology?
And it was 4 pages forward then.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you. I got it right. We're good. Are we all in attendance with our physical documents?
Mr. Chair, we're just commenting that we're not quite as user-friendly with the technology as we thought we might be, but we're working on it. We're there.
And lady.
Thank you, Chair Westman, committee members. My name is Jim Adams. I'm the trial court administrator for Jackson County. As you just heard, Jackson County is deeply committed to the concept of our courts working in partnership with our community. Two observations. After attending 2 days of hearings before this body regarding the modernization of OGIN, it is clear that this committee expects integrated court services with law enforcement, state and local agencies, and our business partners. It is also abundantly clear that the committee will require any new resources dedicated to the modernization of OGIN to increase staff efficiencies, increase in productivity, increase justice services, improve measures and outcomes. I would ask you to refer to this chart that's before you in the lower right-hand corner. I'm simply going to touch on seven key issues or benefits that the modernization of
OGIN... Jim, tell us where the chart is. Got it.
I'm sorry. The blue book, page 4. Okay. The modernization of OGIN will provide for 7 key community benefits. The first is that OGIN will respond to our partners by providing real-time information over the Internet and create the ability for trial courts to respond locally to information issues. Chair Westman, if I can, I'd like to acknowledge the insight of Senator Hannon's inquiries yesterday when he inquired as to whether or not the OJD's Information Services Department would decentralize programming staff and trial courts to allow for rapid, timely, and effective application software. The answer to that is yes, the package does provide for local technology positions. Just within our community recently, over the last couple of months, we received a substantial grant, over $400,000, to implement domestic violence programs. The courts will be a key player in the provision of information services to our agencies. We need the technology to do that. Similarly, we're implementing a number of community policing programs. Those programs need timely information about probation or parolee addresses, continuous updates, program performance, et cetera. We can deliver that information in the field if we have this technology. Secondly, the modernization of OGIN will automate real-time information exchange and information, what we refer to as multi-directional. We can have outside agencies update our database as well as we can update other agencies' databases. Example, DA information could come in and substantially increase the productivity of the courts by not requiring us to enter redundant information. We, too, can share the deficiency of other state agencies like services for children and families, juvenile departments, local probation parole offices by automatically transferring data on sentencing judgments. Thirdly, the modernization of OGIN will make court technology easy to use. The plan calls for the migration from a code-based system to Windows point-and-click technologies. That will increase staff efficiency. That will decrease staff training requirements. that will increase the use of OGIN by our community partners, which will in turn decrease the need for calling in to us to pull up that information and provide it to them. In Jackson County, the Adult Probation Parole Office has approximately 25 users signed on. In the last 3 months, over half of them have not accessed OGIN. We did a survey to find out the reason for that, and the overwhelming response was non-user-friendly access and technologies. 4, the modernization of OGIN is imperative to support specialty courts in any effort for the Oregon Judicial Department to go beyond the conventional case-based justice model and focus on our shared goals with you of improving justice services, outcomes, and community partnerships. However, we need the technology to support those programs. The plan moves from a case-managed system, which means we focus on the case number and the movement of the case throughout the process, to an individual system where cases are all linked to a common person. Also, the software plan before you has the advantages of allowing for the tie in the network of family court and other specialty court information to link all family members. That's imperative for family courts in Jackson, Deschutes, and all the emerging counties that are interested in these programs. It's imperative for the many drug courts throughout our state, and I know there's several people on this committee that have jurisdictions with drug courts, including specialty courts or specialty functions like pretrial release services. 5, the modernization of OGIN will provide timely and important information for decisions. This committee's heard voluminous testimonies from judges on the need for that. I won't go there. The policymakers at both sides of this table, on your side and our side, as court administrators, state court administrator, and the Chief Justice, we need to be able to drill down through a data warehouse of information for research and policy decisions. And finally, our community agencies need to be able to access vital court information to support public safety programs as well as business issues. 6, better information will simply lead to better outcomes. And 7, the modernization of OGIN will support tailored business applications. Trial courts must respond to our business partners. We must provide landlord-tenant information for landlord-tenant associations and owners of rental properties. We must provide lienable judgments and satisfactions for both banks and title companies. We must provide personal injury claim histories of the courts to state agencies like SAFE. In closing, the Oregon trial courts want to provide justice services that are efficient, effective, accountable, and integrated within our communities. However, we need the technology to deliver. It is my sincere recommendation to you that the package before you will provide our common and shared goals. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Adams? Tim, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Carl Ward. I'm the IS Director for the Judicial Department. I thought I would wrap up this integrated justice environment discussion with just a couple of fairly concrete example of the kind of future savings and efficiencies that we envision by implementing this, and then turn our attention to the graph, because as I redid that graph, it revealed a couple of, I think, interesting things to me that I hadn't even really sort of thought through before that are important to this discussion. If a state trooper stops you now and gives you a traffic ticket, he or she writes it on the ticket. They take it back to their office, where somebody may or may not key it into the state police or local law enforcement system. They bundle those up every 2 or 3 days. They ship them a bundle of usually several hundred, depending on the size of the court, to the court. Somebody at the court actually starts a case and then enters that data into our system. Later on, if the person was actually guilty of speeding, say, and just decides to mail in a check, they mail in a check. Another court clerk opens the mail, logs in all of those checks, passes the checks off to accounting. It's a control thing to another person in accounting, where the person in accounting enters the financial transaction of the check. They bundle them up. They send them off to the bank. They close the case at the same time. So for the courts, clerks have touched that case, that traffic ticket, three times. At least a couple of different clerks, maybe three different clerks have touched that. Not that they just mail it in and pay it, it's done, the case is closed. Plus law enforcement has touched it a couple of times. In the future integrated justice environment, ideally the state police would capture the data on the road when he issues the ticket, but maybe he doesn't and it gets keyed in state police office. Ultimately, the goal for the court would be to receive that information electronically. That case could be filed and acted in the court. No court person, no court clerk would ever have to look at or even think about or know that that traffic ticket existed. If we could make the fact that you owe a certain amount of money known to you by way of the internet, for example, you could look up your traffic ticket on the internet because you've got the citation number, trooper gave you a ticket. If you could pay with your credit card, we could receive that money electronically. We could receive that money electronically. We could close that case. No person in the court would ever have to look at or even know that that traffic ticket existed unless some sort of problem arose. So I can't give you a dollar amount on that, but, you know, we did a half a million tickets, traffic tickets, in fractions a year, I guess. So there's a lot of opportunity in there to save money. My other example is we talked some about CGCDI and just sort of the exchange of business transactions between the courts, and I pointed out that we do about a half million now, but fully implemented, we could probably be doing about 3.5 to 4 million court business transactions a month, about a third of them going out of the court. If you look at the kinds of cost savings that consultants usually point to, they usually point to $2 or $3 or $4 or $5 per transaction because they're saying they include the cost of somebody preparing that, they include the cost of copying it, putting it in an envelope, a stamp, mailing it, all of that stuff. So it's usually $3 or $4 or $5. If you just look at a nickel per transaction, the cost that it cost me to copy that, and I probably copy every one of them because I file it in the case file. If you just look at a nickel per transaction, you could save $4.2 million per biennium. About a third of that probably actually in the course if you implemented the entire sort of spectrum of CJIS business transactions. You know, that's a lot of effort that's floating around out there that could be regained, but it takes a lot of changes to our existing systems, both ours and other agencies. So those are the benefits I see. I will pause for questions.
Just a quick you're dealing with round numbers, 500,000 traffic tickets on an annual basis?
You know what the number is? Per biennium.
Per biennium. That's a little more powerful, because I'm just doing some quick math, and I mean, you know, that's over 1,000 a day, and I'm going, you know, backing that back down, that's like 1,100 an hour, every hour, I'm going, you know, wait a minute.
So, actually 550 per hour.
Yeah. Something. Okay. I don't know, I feel safer out there.
That's all impression.
Please continue. Any other questions? Great.
This chart,
yes.
You requested another version of. We do have a couple of interesting things to you that I hadn't really thought of before. If you look at the blue number on the left-hand side of the page that's 6,259, that's how many users we currently have. And interestingly, that line is indicating a trend that, in fact, is lowering my cost of doing business. And, in fact, we have a moratorium on new users from city and county agencies, and I am lowering my cost of business. However, that's a trend that you don't want to see happen. I mean, you don't want to see, I would argue, less people using OGM. You want to see that number increasing, and it would be increasing if we weren't actually refusing to commit new people right now because we can't afford it.
Sure. Representative Brzezinski. Could you just, I was wondering if I could catch everything that you talked about yesterday, commitments outside of the Capitol. Can you tell me what that user number reflects? I mean, who are those users? I mean, besides counties, I guess it seems to me to be pretty high. Are these individual computers that are
okay to address Kate on Ogen?
Representative Krasanski, these are individuals.
Okay.
So those are people we have assigned a user profile to.
So for me as a prosecutor, for me to get stuff off of Ogen, I have a login number that my dispatch may be using to get into any type of records and stuff like that.
That's correct. And actually, each individual in your office,
right,
typically, although there is a fair amount of sharing of user profiles going on out in agencies today. So that's the number of user profiles, the number of individuals, if anything, is probably a little higher.
Okay. Thank you.
And the breakdown is about 2,000 city, county, state agencies, 2,000 public business users, basically, and 2,000 judicial department employees.
Okay.
So it's about a one-third split each way. So the actual line in terms of number of users of OGIN is really headed in the wrong direction for integrated and digital environment right now. There's an artificial lid on that that I hope we're going to get solved this morning. The other interesting thing that popped out to me on this graph, as we put our actual budget numbers on there, which is the red line, and those red numbers are our actual actual appropriation dollar amounts, not adjusted in any way. So we actually, since 1989-91, we have decreased a little bit each biennium in the actual dollars that we have received.
For IT?
For technology, the technology budget in the department. The green line from our fiscal department is the Consumer Price Index from Portland, as I understand it, applied to our 1989-91 appropriation. So, in other words, our appropriation was $9.2 million in 89-91. If we just followed that inflation index, we would be in here in base asking for 13.3 for standard base. The interesting thing that popped out to me in that number is if you add up the gap between our actual dollar numbers and the consumer price index inflation number, it adds up to 14.8 million, which is really has a certain amount of symmetry with the 15.3 that we're asking for. In large part, as catch up for being behind the curve in years past. So
that gap was how much, Carl?
14.8. If you include this biennium, we're asking for. My base this biennium is 9.2, interestingly the same as 89.91 in actual dollars.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Hand. Carl, as you look in the scale you've given us, it looks like the red, the technology budget, actual dollars, is coming back up in comparison to me towards the green somewhere. You have that pointed out so far where it's either going to come up to or basically as the green line?
Senator Hanning, if I understand your question, there's two answers. My base budget request this biennium is 9.2. That's probably about a straight line increase from that 8.7 up. The answer for when it's going to meet the green line is depends on what you guys do. It could meet it today.
Or it could dramatically.
Or it could change.
I can assure you that it would not need it today. So I guess we have to dwell on the other option.
You know, if you look at this and just run them out, and I know, you know, the magic of your. How old was this computer printer that you, color printer that you ran this out on?
Well, it, seriously, this, that is from last biennium.
The what?
The printer's from last biennium. So sometime in 95, 97.
But if you run these two lines, I mean, it does not look like they're closing the gap.
They'll never meet.
I mean, it looks like a parallel line. So
that's what I was trying to get at, Mr. Chairman. Is there supposed to be that much of a gap from here on out, or is there a period of time when it might close the gap?
You can't close the gap today.
No, I didn't ask, and nor will I ask.
But perhaps tomorrow.
Okay.
Not figuratively. Okay, this is a great. And then your 10,000 number, if you can just extrapolate what you thought the white circle, your use would be, your users would be, if you continue to on that.
Sure, Westland. That's correct. We had, at some point in time, estimated where we thought we would be. And if we had not imposed our attempted to impose the charging of fees on state agencies, if we had continued with basically encouraging them to hook up and providing that access for free, we'd probably be there today at 10,000. I mean, we really have reversed the trend by clamping down on that.
And then part of this gets back to Mr. Adams' testimony with regard to not being user-friendly and just difficulty hooking up. And
well,
is that reflected in this gap?
Sure, Westland. I think that being more user-friendly would certainly encourage more people to actually use it. But even without that, if we could afford to support it, we would today be very close to that 10,000 number, I think. I mean, really, you want to have access to those court records on the desktop of every criminal justice user and human resource user in the state. Who wants access to it? I mean, you just want to, if they can access it, even if it's only once a month when they need it, you want them to be able to do that, because otherwise they're either not getting that information that they need to make that decision, or they're calling us on the telephone. And then they're costing us money. So, and how many are there out there? There are more than 10,000.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at with Mr. Adams' testimony with regard to making some of this stuff user-friendly. Would this 10557 be higher?
Yes, I think it would. And the other thing that you would see that significantly increase, I think, is the ability of the public to access it. Because high-volume users, they get to know your system, they understand what's going on, but to the casual user, it's fairly obscure.
Okay. Any questions for Carl at this juncture? Great.
The other issue that we have before you, we have described as the OGIN access fees issue, and a very brief history of that is in 1994, with authorization from the legislature, we started charging private business customers, basically, to dial up and access OGIN. That we have about 2,000 of those users now. They basically pay for the access that we provide to them. They're dialing in by some old equipment. We need to update that. That's all part of this picture. But that is pretty much a self-funding activity. Early in this biennium, I realized that a couple of things were happening. Number one, requests for new accesses and requests for changes to our obsolete connections, especially the city and county agencies, were outstripping our ability to respond to those requests. I mean, we just simply didn't have the resources, the human resources, to be able to assign people to those projects to make them happen. In addition, a lot of that equipment was obsolete, so we just didn't have the money to upgrade what were old analog type modems to sort of newer equipment and pay for the connections and just sort of send people out and make it happen. We just couldn't afford to do it. Over the course of the biennium, we've built up a backlog of 35 city, county, state agencies. I think my program manager for that area tells me that represents probably about 2,000 users, probably about 2,000 user profiles that are backlogged out there wanting access to OGIN, just over this biennium that do not have access to OGIN. We didn't start out with this moratorium on new access. Early in the biennium, when I realized I had this problem, I thought the way to solve it was to charge city, county, state agencies for access. Yes, Kingsley points out to me that backlog list is on page 7 of this technology partnership handout.
That's the backlog list?
That's the backlog list. The business users pay for access. They felt like they were getting value for their money. If you look at any individual user, although we have people that pay thousands of dollars a month, the charge is relative because it's based on utilization. I looked at the county and state agencies, and I thought, well, for any individual agency, since it's based on use and that roughly correlates to the size of the agency, the charge for any agency is not going to be that much. So probably without the sort of consensus building legwork that should have gone into a change like that, we notified city, counties, and states that we were going to start charging them on the next budget cycle, and of course they thought that was a terrible idea. They raised some pretty legitimate points, the key one being that charging CGIS, especially agencies for access to court information, is really counterproductive to an integrated CGIS environment. I think that's probably a pretty legitimate complaint. You really do want that information to be able to flow back and forth. So since we got a lot of resistance and really unhappy customers in the form of city and county agencies, we took a step back at the chief's urging our direction, invited all of the stakeholders in for a meeting to help us come up with an agreeable solution. And basically the solution that we came up with was that we would maintain the status quo through the biennium until we went through the budget session and sort of saw where we would come out on the other side, and that we would ask the legislature to help us solve this in some way or other, fund it in our base budget, fund it from other funds, come up with a solution. What we did in the department was we actually took the OGIN Internet Access Package, which we developed to be in our enterprise account, with the idea that we were going to charge these agencies for access, and we moved that into our essential packages. So that specific package especially, to some extent, CGIS EDI, the data warehouse, package also will contribute to this solution, but especially that package is the basically the dollar figure for solving this problem, in the sense that the state would pay for the next biennium's continued access by whoever wants to access those now. That covers my cost. At the beginning of the biennium, this was chewing up about 10% of my budget. Any measure you want to look at, help desk calls, machine utilization, number of staff I was having assigned to it, just any way I wanted to look at it, it was just consuming that resource, and I just couldn't afford to do it.
I just wanted to add context to the 10%. When you say 10% of your budget, it's 10% of the general funded budget that was there for the trial court.
True.
So it's not like 10% of a budget that the money was there to provide the access. It's money that went away from trial court support to support the information going to the public safety agencies. And that's where the alarm bells went off. I said, the courts are out there crying. They can't get support. They can't get programs. They can't get this. What are we doing? We're using 10% now of our general fund appropriation for the trial court to support this other access, and that's when the letter went out and kind of all heck broke loose, because it had been a gradual thing, and it just crept up until the demand was pretty intrusive. So
just a clarification, 10% of your technology budget for trial courts, or 10% of the total general fund for trial courts?
Technology.
It's about $800,000, representing credit. So in sort of conclusion to this, the committee, either in the integration hearings or earlier in our budget hearings, has sort of started the discussion of, can we raise the rates? Are we charging our public users enough? And what are sort of alternatives to funding this besides just putting it into our budget from other funds? So we did a little quick research. One thing that we looked at on page 8 of this handout is, what are the value-added resellers of court information charging for access to their own information systems? And so you've got a list on there of commercial information systems, CourtLink, LexisNexis. And although we charge based on utilization, so it's not really an hourly rate, if you look at the big picture, we charge about $10 to $13 an hour, is about the way that it works out for OGIN access to get out into the court. These guys charge anywhere from $10 to $12 a search, which doesn't really translate to $45, $84 an hour. So in terms of access with the commercial market, we're probably charging half to a quarter of what they're actually charging. But now these guys are value-added resellers, so they do other things with this information, combine it with other information, make it easier to use, do all sorts of other things. So that's that picture. The other thing we did is, right, our costs are at the bottom of that page. With,
just so I track real well on this, currently you said OG's charging the bottom line, bottom of the page is $10 to $13 per hour. Their total would come to about $84 per hour. Did you say that? Like
Courtland is charging $84 an hour.
And then CIS would be, say, $4 to $10 per record. That would also come out to about $84. Is that what you said?
No. Really, that's a per access charge, so it could be anything. It could be $4 an hour, or it could be probably $200 or $300 an hour, depending on what you do. So there's no real, there's no translation for hourly rate on that. The other handout that I have that was with this was a table. Let me see if I can find it. It's not flipped to it. It looks like this. With a single page table. We also checked what other states were charging for access, so basically our peers in other states. And what we found was that not including the states that provide free access, because there are starting to be states that provide free access, especially by way of the internet, to the court records, Wisconsin, for one. I think Florida is on here. They provide free access. The average cost is $22 an hour, so I would conclude from that that if we just wanted to be average, we could raise our rates 20-30%. It would generate another couple $100,000. If the market would bear that, we'd have to get some thought. We were behind on our rates, and we raised them early in this biennium about 30% as a catch-up, and had intended to raise them on an inflationary rate into the future. When we took that 30% jump, we did start to knock off some of the people at the sort of bottom end of the scale. So the revenue still increased. We still made more money, but I would say from a public policy perspective, you don't want to go too far in sort of knocking people off who want access to your system, but otherwise you won't do it just because it's expensive.
Well, give us an example of that people you knocked off.
Well, I can't give you specific examples, but what we have out there in our sort of business community, at the top end, we have Intel, TechClients. Those are the big spenders. At the bottom end, you have people who are individual property managers, for example, who are checking on whether people owe a lot of money to the court and using that to make some sort of decision for renting property to somebody. So you have, basically at the bottom end, you have an individual in a very, very small business. Or a law firm, good point, small law firm. And so the decision they're making is, the other way we changed our rate was we also started charging a $10 per user profile fee. And so at a minimum, they were looking at $10 a month just to stay on whether they use it or not. So they're making a decision probably that $20 a month is more than they're willing to pay to have access to the system.
All right.
You know.
Sure, that's hardly anything. I mean, they don't deserve access. We might comment on that. But still, he's making a price elasticity type comment with regard to overall revenue versus cost operating the system, and you think you're doing okay. I mean, I agree with Representative Trader. I agree with your action of cutting those off. But at some point in time, as you raise those rates, revenue is going to go down.
Sure, Wesley, that's exactly right. And the other thing, as I said, is at some point you are knocking people off of there that you don't want to knock off, even though you may still be increasing revenue. I mean, you may make it a great money-making system, but you may be actually costing the courts more money because people are now going back into the courthouses that they used to in the past into the file room and getting this information. So there's a balance in there.
How do you do the math for me, if you don't mind? You mentioned raising the rates possibly 30-40%. I think it's what dollars that would raise, and also what doubling it would raise. In other words, from 10 to 13 to 20 to 26.
Representative Schrader, the appropriation that we're asking for next budgeting is $1 million, and we figure we'll carry a couple hundred thousand over. So we're working with $800,000 to $1 million. So if you double it, you've made another $1 million. If you raise it by 50%, you made $500,000.
Is that based on?
That's if everybody continued to use it as they use it today, too. One thing that we saw clearly when we told states.
Appropriation, you meant expenditure limitation.
Yeah.
Spend that much. Okay.
But we base that on what we believe revenue will be. So.
Right. Understood.
The other thing that we saw when we raised rates was people that stay on, especially at the lower end, they use it more conservatively as well. So you may not be able to double your rates and double your revenue. So I don't think you could double your rates. I think that we can raise them at an inflationary rate. We may be able to do more than that and make more money. Can you make another $1 million out of that from the business users? I think you would be really pushing it. Can you do that over the next 5 years? Yeah, probably you'll be there in 5 years, but I don't think you could do that overnight.
Yeah. On the $1 million, that's business and public agencies, is that correct?
Representative Schrader, no, I'm just talking about public users, business agents. Well, I'm confusing the issue by calling them business. We actually don't have any really members of the public, individuals that are just sort of casually accessing the system. They're really all business users, but they're non-government.
We're confusing each other probably just a little bit. Sorry about that. It's probably my fault. I guess I was trying to get at including the intels and small business down to a small law firm. That's one group.
Right.
And there's law enforcement and courts, the county outfits that use the system too. How much is raised from each group presently? How much would be raised if you increase the fees? If you double this, for example, I understand you don't have necessarily double.
Mr. Schrader, are you asking me how much we'd raise if we actually charge city, counties, and state agencies, which we don't do now?
That's correct.
Almost exactly the same. Same number of users and historically about the same utilization in the last biennium that we look at it. So we would raise another $1 million by charging city, county, and state agencies, or $800,000 per million.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schrader more or less asked the question. So I remember I asked this question before in regards to Intel. And how much? And how much did you say at that time that they were paying this and probably could pay four times that, which I think was one of the reasons we got to the front of this today.
Mr. Chair,
I'm hearing confusing figures.
Senator Tim, I think just off the cuff, Intel probably pays about $500 a month. The last time I can remember looking at it, it could be higher now. But
and you mentioned it could be four times that for the service that was provided.
Senator Timms, I think Intel probably could afford to and would pay four times as much without blinking an eye. So for the top 10% of the users, see, that's not a problem. It's what happens as you get down. Most of our users are not of Intel size. Most of our users are less than $100 a month.
That was the biggest employer in the state.
Right. And we've got about four of them, four business users that are that size. The other thing I'll just comment on is many of the cities and counties said that they couldn't afford to pay for this use and in fact would be forced to go back to manually accessing the court records, basically calling this up on the phone or going into the courthouse. So,
and that's cheaper for them.
Well, I don't think it is cheaper for them actually, but that doesn't mean that they won't do it.
Representative Patridge. I have a question and a comment. If we fund the technology package on your OGIN internet access piece, which is $900,000, what happens to the revenues that's being raised now? What happens to those individuals? Are you going to continue to charge people to access it through the internet, or do we lose the Intel and the rest of the users fall off? What's the court's plan for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Packridge, To some extent, I could take my direction from you guys, but the answer to that is the money that we charge now are for the public users, and they're paying their own way, and we would need to continue to charge them for that. The OGIN Online Internet Access Package takes care of the city, county, state costs of those users, supporting those users. But the other thing that it does do is it allows us to develop and make the information available by the Internet. So in the long run, once that happens, that actually probably does lower our cost of providing that access. So we could be at a point, at that point in time, of making a decision of actually lowering our cost to everyone if we wanted to. Doesn't mean that we have to. We've already got the users out there. They're paying a certain rate. They're used to it. But, in fact, our cost of providing the service goes down when we can deploy the stuff on the Internet for a lot of different reasons.
And I just got a comment that I think as we look at OGIN and we look at court records and those kinds of things, you know, it's great to talk about how much we can charge people and what goes on, but I think there's also kind of an overriding public policy that this is public information that the public needs to have access to and people should have access to, whether you're Intel or someone else out there. So I think we need to be careful as we move forward and look at these, at charging people and those kinds of things, that we get more careful to notice that these are public records that people should have access to so they can do what they need to do as well.
And to augment that comment, I mean we're looking at revenue and talking about trying to cover costs. We're not talking about profit. We're not talking about depreciation of the systems. I mean, there's a lot more that goes into all of this than any type of rational, strict business analysis of what's justified and what isn't. I mean, this is, you know, for the benefit of the justice system, for the benefit of the public, and we as a body have to recognize that. Representative Kozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been following up, but it seems like as we want to include more people and getting them in the position to get access to the data quicker and sooner, we need to have an update continue to go forward. And I'm wondering, do we have some way to track how many times an individual user is into OGIN?
Representative Kozanski, we do that. I mean, we have that information.
And then in doing so, in pricing out the service that we provide for people, is there any discussion or consideration as to, such as on the higher end users, having maybe minimum levels for each group, but then have, if you reach a certain number, the charges would fluctuate or vary? Because it seems to me that you could keep the cost down for maybe the individual one-time, two-time user as compared to someone that's actually taking a product that they do have access to because it is public, but making it added value and then selling it. It would seem like those are the individuals that should be willing to pay for the efficiency of getting material quicker than having someone go to the various courthouses to try to gather that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kozanski, I think you're exactly on the right track for the future model. Probably if you look out 4 or 5 years, and if you said this was done, really what you're seeing probably is that the individual case records, including all the documents, are really publicly available for free, and you no longer charge for those. They're accessible on the Internet to anyone, business and private alike. And what you are then charging businesses for, or still charging businesses for, is to provide them with tailored information to their needs, because that's what they would really rather have anyway, and they will gladly pay for that. So in other words, most of those businesses out there that are looking at cases, they don't want to look at those individual cases. They really want to look at one specific aspect for everything that happened on that kind of case for that whole day. Title companies just care about the dollar amounts on judgments, you know. Credit companies just care about a different thing. Investigators, I mean, you go right down the business list, they have a really targeted need that they would much rather have met in a specific way to them than looking at the individual cases. On the other hand, the public, the bar, CJIS, those guys are all after the full information on the case, not just what we have on OGIN now, which is just sort of a very complex and big summary, but they'd like to see everything, including the documents, which we'd like to put out there for them. And that should be free, I think, in the long run.
I'm just trying to put together in my mind here now, we're on item number 2, OGIN, Integrated Justice Environmental Technology Investment, and 1 is the first step in the raise in the current service level, right?
Yes.
So that's $11.2 million. And then we get down to number 2, which is the OGIN, $10.7 million. So we have that in the priority format on the. Now, have I missed that in the process?
Chair Westland, Senator Kim, we do. Our number, and it was probably attached to yesterday's that said kind of the chief one pager, and then they had just the one sheet technology. The 4.1, that's what we call the base remainder, which is the...
What page is that now, please?
Okay. It should be the second page to yesterday's
handout. He's on the drug court.
There. Okay. Thank you, Senator.
No problem. I paid that.
our number 1 priority actually is the integrated justice environment, which is $7.8 million. We have to though get past the $4.6 million in base to get to our number 1 priority, because the base parts, which were the 1.5 of the information system base, because it'll say base budget remainder, and then the green screen, those two really are the underpinning to even be able to use the integrated justice environment. And if we can't hook up to what we create, if we don't have the computers and have the memory and the capacity, what we create doesn't do anything.
So
that's why those two are together. And then the partner projects, which are always important. But if you said, what do we need to do our business, it's the base remainder, it's the integrated justice environment. The partner projects we're totally committed to, and that's why the Chief Justice put them in his program maintenance level. But in order of priority, it's our base remainder, because we have to. The integrated justice system, which is our top priority, but we can't get to it unless we take care of the base.
I believe
the partnership.
If you go to page 6 of the blue handout that's called technology. Basically what Kingsley is talking about is what's contained on that page. It's the top part, it is the 4.6 that she refers to, and then the bottom section is the 7.4. Okay. Yes, sir. And also the 358,000 that's on page 7.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets you down to $15.3 million total, but chopped up into the 3 priorities.
I'll say that again. Where are you there when you say that?
At the very bottom of page 7, and the sum total for technology is $15.3 million.
Okay.
If we were to go back to page 6. The first shaded line says 4.6, and above that is what we call our base remainder needs, the items that we argue should be part of the base budget for technology, because they're the, you know, the buttons that allow us, they're what Representative Mannix asked yesterday, what are you asking for? We're asking to be able to use what we've already created as base remainder to support that. The next item, which says integrated justice environment, which flips over on to the next page for a total of $7.8 million is what we've been hearing about, the integrated justice environment, and that's the usefulness. That's taking us from code-based to Windows-based programs and ability to support staff in our universe. We call it usefulness. It's taking, and it's also, those two items together are taking the car the next 100,000 miles it needs to go. Then the next item, the 2.8, is what we call the partnership project. Those are things that were kind of got one leg in and one leg out. The senior CDI, the internet, the data warehouse, the video conferencing. But we don't need those to do our daily business, except if we have them, they help us do our business more efficiently and effectively, but they also help the greatest number of other users in state government and local government.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to say, I know we'll go through this in a work session, but the point is it helps me put together in my mind what is there and available at a certain amount of money in the process.
And these numbers, within these numbers we talked yesterday, there's some one-time cost. It's not a huge sum, but there's in the base, there's about $1 million. There's about $3 million of one-time in the integrated justice environment, and then there's a little bit more, and I think it's another, I'll have to go back and reference this, it's another over $1 million in the partnership, which we call the one-time because they're development cost issues. And then these are all mostly based on 24-month numbers, and we have some, you know, we can work with some phase-in, so depends on how fast you want to get.
Kingsley, it would be helpful in this process to have a dialogue with you and say how much is needed to keep the patient going versus how much is above and beyond that we would like to have but we can't have. Can you break that out for us?
I do, and on that page, and I'm not trying to be flip on, I would say the 15.3 is what we believe we need
because
of the type of projects that they involve.
Okay.
And then we have a policy package that's the policy package 105 that's the technology beyond current maintenance.
Right.
And that's about $17 million of good things to have or things we could do if you have specific interest in them. And that right now, we've put on the sidebar, even though some of those I think are important, and said those wait until we find how much we can take care of.
But the $15 million is essential.
That is what we would argue is essential, yes. Sir.
Okay, thank you.
Are you ready to move on? I'm afraid you're getting behind on the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's quite all right. And we are, again, perpetually behind. Any other quick questions for our technology people? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim, thanks for coming, Carl, for the Inkley. Okay, listen. Rush right into our drug court people. Judge Gerald Larson and Gary Brandt, Justine Crawford Administrator.
Mr. Chair, Justine for the discussion. The handout today is says Fiscal Guide to Tuesday.
That's good. The way you did it.
And the first item is behind the pages, drug support program. And Judge Larson and Gary are going to speak to the policy issue of drug court, the concept of outcomes and why that matters. What you have on the sheet, which we can get back to when we come back to wrap up, is all the parts of our budget that relate to drug court. Some are general fund requests. Most of them are federal funded other firms' limitations, and then actually we have drug courts and some courts where the money is coming from neither general fund nor federal fund. But they're going to talk to you first about what is a drug court and why is that an important part.
Thank you, Kinsley. Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, my name is Darrell Larson. I am a circuit court judge in Eugene, and just by way of reference as to who I am or where I'm coming from, I was a prosecutor for about almost 19 years in the DA's office in Eugene. I've been a judge for about 9 years. And I'd like to begin by saying that many of you probably are, and I know are, familiar with the term drug courts, but you may not really understand how they function or whether or why you should support their growth in the state of Oregon. Perhaps I should begin by asking you what you would call a criminal court, which gets nonviolent offenders into court within a day or so of being charged, at first appearance offers a chance to go into drug treatment, which dispenses with the grand jury process, drug testing by the state crime lab, motions to suppress evidence, jury trials, and appeals that should result from those trials, and thereby avoids time loss to judges, court staff, the district attorney, defense counsel, and appellate counsel, and avoids all overtime pay for police witnesses at every stage of the process. A court which reduces per capita indigent defense costs and focuses the system on changing the offender rather than processing the offender, which requires the offender to admit all elements of the crime in order to enjoy the benefits of drug treatment, and results in a 5-minute summary trial on the spot and sentencing if they eventually fail to satisfy the judge that they're treatable, which gets offenders from handcuffs to drug treatment within days instead of months or not at all, which provides direct daily judicial supervision and oversight of all participating offenders, which dramatically reduces the number and frequency of failures to appear in court, which reduces the number of bench warrants processed by the court system, thereby reducing police time loss and jail costs and overcrowding in county jails due to warrant arrests, which actually increases the respect and compliance with court mandates by most offenders, which imposes immediate sanctions for noncompliance and positive reinforcement for compliance with court directives, thereby maximizing the impact of the resources that are actually spent, which reduces the number of jail days imposed for noncompliances while nevertheless increasing the impact of jail sanctions that are imposed. A system which reduces the number of persons on supervised probation, thereby maximizing probation officers' time to supervise other sentenced offenders who may in fact pose even greater personal risk to the public. A court which materially improves outcomes with drug-affected offenders, including reduction of recidivism, drug usage, food stamp usage, reduces homelessness, family dysfunction, which provably reduces SDF intervention and out-of-home placements of children, which increases the acquisition and level of employment and education, and not to mention the payment of taxes instead of the use of taxes, which reduces work injuries and safe claims, which improves physical health and family functioning, which reduces the number of drug-affected and low birth weight babies born in the state of Oregon, which I might say by footnote, Sacred Heart Hospital indicated to me in the NIC unit, cost about $225,000 per throw on startup costs for initial costs to hospitals for drug-affected babies, and which regularly has offenders publicly thanking police officers for arresting them because it provided them with the opportunity to be in the court process that they're in, and often has offenders at the end of that process thanking the judge and everyone else involved in the system, including the prosecutor, for saving their life. After 5 years of working in such a court, I can tell you what I call such a court. I call that court a drug court. The establishment of drug courts is very clearly in the best interest of the state of Oregon. It does not matter whether your primary public policy concern is maximizing the bang for the taxpayer buck or increasing public safety, or improving the public health and the human condition. The answer remains the same. Drug courts get the job done better, faster, and cheaper. There have now been enough research done and personal experience with drug court models to clearly demonstrate the public policy and outcome superiority of that model. I believe that is why the expansion of drug courts has become a judicial department priority and explains why there were only about 20 drug courts in 1994 when the Lane County Drug Court was started, and why there are over 500 drug courts today in the United States and in other countries.
Drug courts encourage and utilize community involvement and often work with the private sector to forge partnerships with the private community, all of which is consistent with the 2020 vision plan of the Judicial Department, which would focus the court system on things such as prevention, partnerships, and accountability. And you just heard some of the technology testimony here, which is certainly in keeping with what we're trying to get done in the drug court process. Legislation supporting the expansion of funding of the treatment that would be utilized by drug courts has been forwarded to this committee, by House Judiciary Committee. And when time permits, we would be pleased to testify further and answer your questions concerning that legislation and why that legislation plays such an integral part of being able to do the work of drug courts. I might also say, just for general knowledge, that drug courts have started without any legislation specifically directing either their creation or formation or regulation in the state of Oregon. So legislation isn't needed really for Oregon to have drug courts. But I can tell you for a fact that a mature drug court can't do its job without money for treatment. And so that is a crucial part of what we need. I also want to explain to you that several sets of material have been passed out. We seem to be invited back multiple times here to this presentation. So when I was here the other day, I think Thursday, I left a copy of my testimony that's pretty much consistent with what I've given here today. And I also attached to that, and I'll just hold it up so you can see what I'm referring to, is a document that looks something like this. It's a multi-page document, and at the top it says OJC, Drug Court Clearing Health and Technical Assistance Project. It's a list of all the drug courts in the United States as of about a month ago, and there's a lot of them. There are a lot of them on the drawing board. Today, when I came, I also had staff pass out a document that looks like this, and there are a lot of things attached in here, and I've left that for your just general knowledge and guidance about what the drug courts are, how they work. There's a summary sheet that follows, I think, the first full page of that that looks like this. It says summary by entity. That breaks down by specific entities within the criminal justice system how that system or that particular part of the entity is affected by the drug court process. And I think there's some money figures tied to that. Those money figures are Wayne County's figures, not some other jurisdiction.
Sure. Representative Minnis.
I just had a question on page 2 of this handout. On the second line, the Wayne County Drug Court Treatment options are funded through the Oregon Health Plan, 40-50%. And then others are funded through community corrections, community state, or project state. What's the one? Why is there a difference?
The difference in what?
Well, one, the treatment's funded by the health plan in one county. And then
it isn't just one county. Any county can access the Oregon Health Plan for people that are eligible. And really, that's the focus of the drug courts. We really have consistently tried to get people onto the Oregon Health Plan who are eligible for that plan because it stretches the dollar further. Most of the drug courts actually charge a fee, which is, I think, not the same in all counties, either in terms of the amount or the way that it's imposed. But in our county, we charge what's called a compensatory fine to compensate the system, if you will, for the spending that has to go into the drug treatment. That's a very small portion of what the cost of drug treatment is, but we're trying to stretch those dollars as far as we can. The irony is that there really is some federal money out there available for new startup drug courts. But for mature drug courts like ours, that money is no longer available. And so as we have more courts in the state that have been around a long time, we really need to find local and state resources to be able to pay for the balance of that treatment.
So only Lane County at this point is accessing? That's on the list of the access.
I think that, I didn't do that particular chart, but I think that's intended really to be instructive of particular counties and what they are doing to.
Okay.
Thank you.
You mentioned at the beginning that you, all the savings that you achieved through the drug crisis, not avoiding the confrontational process that the jury says, not the trial, et cetera. Have you done any, and yet you do need money for the treatment programs that are the core of the drug court. Have you done a cost-benefit analysis and analyzed what net savings you experience through the use of these courts?
All the courts together. In our particular case, what I did, and some of the figures are in that material I gave you, and you can go through it by...
I know this. Is it all in this, or is it all in here somewhere?
And I can refer you to starting the pages are numbered at the bottom. If you go past page 5, there's an exhibit, a series of exhibits, exhibit number 1, 2, and 3. Exhibit number 3 is a listing, sort of an executive summary I did for actually our county commissioners about specific line items about the worth of dollar savings, or, and I hesitate to use the word savings because some of these are real dollar savings, such as the money that the police departments really didn't have to pay for overtime, and that's a significant amount of money if you add up all the ways that police officers end up getting stuck in the system. But a lot of these are avoided costs. That they either avoided time loss by personnel within the system, or they avoided the cost that would be associated with that specific thing happening in the system because it didn't happen because there was a drug court.
And so those are listed. I still don't have the right hand up.
It looks like this.
Oh, I see. Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Behind page number 1, I mean page number 5 in this handout, and it says exhibit number 1. Okay, I was on a different page 5, if you can believe that.
I apologize, there's some of these documents have been prepared for other entities within the system, and I didn't change all the page numbers.
Chairman, so you do include avoided costs here?
I do. Those are for our county. The drug courts, most of the drug courts that have currently been in existence have purchased a software program called Drug Court PC Plus, and we're still ironing out some of the bugs with that particular program, but we're all getting pretty close to the point where we've got our data entered and are being very close to being able to start punching the button to get data out that's meaningful to us, and I think we'll have much better numbers the next time around for maybe a 3 to 6 year time period. In our particular case, we've got almost 5 years worth of data, which has been entered almost exclusively by kids from high schools doing community service work at no cost to the public. And we've come a long ways, but we still don't have numbers that I would want to rely on from that system.
So do you have a gender breakdown of the people who have been through your drug court?
In our particular county, it's about 60-40.
And success rate, I presume that's in here somewhere.
That hovers around, depends on the month, really, but it hovers around 50 to 60%. That varies, like I say, during the course of the year. One of the things that I've noticed after 5 years of being in the drug court process is that you have drug shifts in terms of the climate of your community. Right now, we're experiencing for the first time in a number of years a major increase with cocaine. I don't know where it's coming from, but it's happening. For the 2 years before this, and you've seen this in other contexts, I'm sure, in your day-to-day process, there's been an enormous increase in heroin use, which is consequently more difficult to treat in some ways, but if you get the right treatment forms, you can do it successfully.
Great. Let's hear from Gary Brandt.
Chairman Westland, my name is Gary Brandt. I'm the trial court administrator for Joaquin County Courts, and I would just like to state one thing, and that is that the local courts have been able to absorb the judicial resources and the time that is taken to operate drug courts. The missing link, as Judge Rushman said, is the mechanism to provide a long-term stable funding source for the treatment of drug court participants. And it's a well-known fact that the treatment is really the glue that holds the entire drug court process together. And unlike other presenters that have appeared before you, we are not here today to ask for general fund monies. Jake Larson and I will plan to appear at a future session of this subcommittee to solicit your support for a modification to the Unitary Assessment Fund to provide that long-term source of funding. And that will come when House Bill 2301 is debated. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Great. Any further questions?
Mm-hmm. I just wondered if we could get a tally of how many other counties who all use the health plan for treatment and what the amount would be. Would it be possible to get that information?
Well, I think, as Judge Larson mentioned, I think every drug court uses the Oregon Health Plan. The treatment provider will have a mechanism to bill the Oregon Health Plan, and that doesn't come through the drug court itself. That goes through the treatment provider. So they do utilize the Oregon Health Plan for treatment.
So we could survey our trial courts and get the head drug courts and get a feel for that information.
Sure.
Both of you indicated that the real key is the money for treatment. That's really not a part of this budget, obviously. Right. Second comment or question would be then that, but one of you said, Ms. Brand, Judge Brand, I believe you said that most of that stuff could be absorbed within the existing court. Is that correct?
Gary Brandt, I'm not. I haven't been elevated to a judge. Probably. We have absorbed in just because of the way the drug courts have progressed through the court system, courts have absorbed the judicial resources, as I said. There are other resources that some courts would like to have that can't afford to, and I can think of one position, that's the drug court coordinator. I don't think Judge Larson has one. They're very beneficial to the drug court, and I think that Douglas County has in one of the cases asked for a drug court coordinator. That's separate and apart from what we're here to do for.
I'm looking at the back of this document. He lists several courts that are looking at getting going and want to do some planning, figure out how to go about it. Is this an exhaustive list of the counties or the courts, if you will, excuse me, the courts that are interested in drug courts? How do we choose these?
Representative Schrader, I think I can answer that in the packet. That's this one.
Yes.
If you look at, once again, after, well, it's on page, it's exhibit number one. At the bottom of that, number three on that page, is the list most recently of the drug courts that are either actually working in Oregon or are on the books being planned as we speak, and there are a number of those.
So there are a number of courts that are not, I would say not interested, but it's not their top priority at this point in time.
Drug courts, not unlike family courts, I think would be fair to say you have to have a champion in that county, someone who's willing to take the time and the effort to do something outside the box to set it up, to get the people in the room to wade through the process of reorganizing the system. And a lot of counties, I think, you're starting to see this progression of drug courts developing around the state because more and more people are beginning to realize from others' experience that it really pays off. And so people are willing to take the time and the effort to champion the process.
And Chair Weissman, if I can also respond to Representative Schrader's question. I think what Judge Larson said is very true. I mean, one, there's been federal money available, so that has created some options for courts to go into drug court where maybe they have some interest in other areas. But they aren't mutually exclusive, as you heard with the family law courts. I mean, there are many variations of drug courts in different courts depending on what their highest need or the players who are interested in that county have started out at different places. You heard in the family courts, they have a number of criminal cases involving drugs and drug usage within the family that they're dealing with. We have courts that are interested in juvenile drug courts, focusing on that aspect. We have ones involving domestic violence and connecting with substance abuse. So there are a number of drug court is kind of one word, but it can be a part of a larger piece, or it can be a standalone, or it can be specialized even within that. And I would say there are a number of jurisdictions that are interested in different aspects. You have an association, and they talk about.
Could I ask a little more direct question then? In fact, McCown, you know, has expressed some interest here recently. I was just wondering why they're not involved in this.
I leave them off Friday after Friday, and I didn't mean to. They do have a plan.
Yeah. Around the bush.
They were on again, off again because of the district attorney's office being on again, off again. So now they're on again as of my discussion with the judge last week, and I believe the money is coming to the county and not directly to the court, but I'll finish finding out that piece. But it has been an on again, off again. That county is
very interesting. 8:45 this morning.
Yeah.
So, okay, any other quick question for our drug court people? Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, general workflow D. Kingsley, you want to introduce and call our English guests?
Yes. This relates to on our, let's see, fiscal guide plan. This is general workflow D. Start on page 3, and we did it's a pretty big piece of the pie, and we talked about different aspects. But this summarizes our total requests in three different ways, and then the details attached. But what I really wanted to draw your attention to right now was kind of the aspect of the workload, the clerical, the day-to-day, the parts that aren't part of family court, the part of access, part of drug court, or the criminal. So we're going to talk a little bit tomorrow about pretrial release and that aspect. I know the word police staff is an immediate turnoff. I mean, people start checking for the, what do they call it, the light in their eyelids, and the brain goes into, you know, cruise control. And because police staff, I mean, it sounds like, why on earth would you need staff if you just did things more efficiently, more effectively, and more technology? Of course, you don't need staff. I would say it's a serious and critical issue in the court. Then it's not a new phenomenon again. This is something that didn't happen overnight. It's progressive. There have not been staff additions since the 91 biennium, apart from the judgeships, apart from specific program pieces like tax magistrates or collections. So this kind of goes to the baseline workload needs. Yes, there are things we can do to be more efficient. There are ways that technology can get us farther. But what's been keeping us alive over time has been that technology. And just like you heard from IS that 10 years ago, 8 years ago, even 6 years ago, they could absorb many new things without additional staffing. They just reworked their priorities. We're at the same point with staffing. I mean, the bucket is full. The stand spills over, and other bad things start happening. I did give you a separate one that I thought was interesting. It said court hours survey, and we had surveyed our courts generally on what their hours are, what their public access times are, when they have after hours hearings, what their starting times are for courts, and also if they had restrictions on their hours, what were the reasons. And you have an opportunity to look through that. I think it would be enlightening. They're in two orders, one just in alpha by county and the other by group size, because different size courts have different needs and conditions. Only 7 of our courts have full service hours, 8 to 5, every day of the week now. And in Clackamas, our average time from a judge signing a judgment decree to entry into OJIN, because entry into OJIN is a statutory effective action to make it have legal significance, is 9.4 calendar days. Our performance measure is 24 hours. So while on the surface, courts are maintaining and getting things done, if you dig below the surface, you say, what has been happening over time? What is, and part of that is what I wanted to bring a few representatives from the different sized courts in to take kind of 5 minutes. So I don't barrage you with a lot of facts that I can give you and provide you, but I want you to hear from about 5 minutes in each of our different sized courts from around the state. What does need staff mean and imply? And then you can ask, can justice be effectively delivered in Oregon without more staff? And if not in certain counties, how can we address this need? The first person I'd like you to hear from is Judge Kramer, who is in one of our smallest sized courts, the one judge court, the family court, one judge court. And he is with the 24th Judicial District, which is Grant and Harney. And I would just like to talk about staff there for a few minutes.
Right, Chairman Westland and esteemed members of the committee, I found out on Saturday that I would have an opportunity to come to speak, and I appreciate the opportunity. Let me tell you that I am, as the presiding judge...
You are who?
Bill Kramer. I apologize. We have two offices, one in Grant County and one in Harney County, and I think it's important to make the point that it takes a certain number of staff simply to keep an office open. Without going into just the daily needs that are there, let me just say you have to answer phones, you have to meet the public, you have to do the data entry. And in Harney County, we have permanent staffing of 1.65 individuals. In Grant County, it's 2.45. That includes all administrative staff. And I would simply point out that the 5.4 full-time employment positions that normally would come along with a new judgeship did not come along with the formation of the 24th district. Again, we have a total of 4.1. That includes the administrative staff. If you really look at staff who are providing the day-to-day work, I would submit that it's something... accounting for the administrative time, it's more in the 3.1 to 3.4 level. What that leaves us with is that when I'm in court, and there's substantially more court days, I'm either generally in Harney County or Grant County, so if I, for example, am in Harney County, that requires a court reporter to be in court with me. And if I'm there half the time, that means that technically I'm left with 0.65 of a person to do all the other functions that an office would be required to do. Because I come from a smaller district, I would simply point out that some of the discussion that we had earlier today, access through OGIN, the local individuals are not used to utilizing OGIN. When they contact us, I can tell you that it's the public walks in, requests information, and so it's a tremendous load on our staff. I would like to point out that in Baker County and in Harney County, we've both recently gone through a situation where we have had a trial court administrator go through a stress-related claim. And so I'm here and telling you as sincerely as I can that work satisfaction and just stress loads are real. And we are trying to do things better. Technology helps, but anytime there's a new mandate to use technology, that requires more training. We don't have the time to send people to training. We don't have the time to send people to try to equate themselves with perhaps a more efficient way to do something because they have to be there in court. If I'm in court, we don't have the additional staff to send somebody to training. I also want to point out that in Harney County, there's been a slight growth in cases, just generally speaking, in both counties, but in Harney County, we recently took on the juvenile caseload that was the responsibility of the county judge up until January 1st of this year. On a pure case number basis, that's probably increased our workload 25%. The way we've survived is through the help of limited duration staff, where we've received within the two counties probably 1.2 full-time employee equivalents. I will just tell you that's not sufficient. What I think we need, and the reason I think the 5.4 is a figure that was recommended for each new judgeship is I think at least between the two offices I need 5.4 staff. let me tell you what the benefit would be, and I don't want to take too much of my time, so I'll try to hurry. First of all, from the staff point of view, it would increase the quality of the work in the sense that there would be additional time to check for accuracy, there would be an increased work satisfaction, there would be better service to the public. In Grant County, we are one of those counties that have restricted our hours to public access. We close the office for everything except for filings at 3 o'clock each day, and that's the only way we can survive to get things done, even with the limited duration that we receive. From my perspective, it would free me up to work on judicial functions. I don't have, for example, a judicial assistant. I do the best I can with my own individual typing. I would love to involve myself more in drug courts and to look at that possibility. There would be some advantage to look at, although I am a single judge in two counties, there needs to be coordination to be effective in the family court area. Even I need coordination with outside agencies. If I had a judicial assistant, for example, that would enable me to make those contacts and to coordinate services and to coordinate with other agencies. As it is now, again, I think I'm being asked to operate on something akin to about half of what would normally be expected with a judgeship. I really don't have the time to do that, and it's simply, not to sound patronizing in any way, but it's simply inefficient, I think, to have a judge trying to do all of their own phone calls and contacts to set up meetings, to set up levels, to try to, for example, I'm close to getting a mediation program off the ground, something that's been mandated by you, the legislature, and I take your mandate seriously, but I can only tell you I can only do what I can do, and we're just now trying to get that off the ground. But if I had additional staff, we would be able to work on those areas. In addition, I'm concerned, I mentioned the burnout of two other, at least what I perceive as the burnout. I guess I can't speak to the whys and wheres of those stress-related claims involving the TCA in Baker County and the trial court administrator in Hardy County prior to my taking the office. I just know that there was that type of claim. But I do have a concern. I've seen the signs of that in some of my own staff, and I insisted that they take some of their accumulated vacation time. I just want to tell you that it's real, that there would be real benefits to me, and that I could focus on doing the work of a judge rather than clerical type work. In the past, I have made myself available to other courts. I tried to help out in Mount Hill County, and I've done that. I traveled over there, and I would be freed up. I would simply have more time if I wasn't attempting to fulfill the type opinions and things of that nature. And I, again, would just like to say, as I've only been a judge for 2 years, I came out of a private law practice where I managed the law practice, and I can tell you if I could run my office the way I ran my law practice, I would certainly put on more staff, because that would make me more efficient, and I think in the long run is cost effective. And finally, I just want to acknowledge, I realize the hard work that you do, and that these are not easy decisions. I think in our area, while I want to work to establish new programs that I think can greatly benefit our area, I think the first and foremost thing is to have an efficient, functioning court. We are all here because we're interested in the same thing, providing for community safety, and to have a well-functioning court is the first step, even before you begin talking about other types of law enforcement. They have to be able to go through the judicial system. Thank you.
I just want to underscore Judge Kramer's testimony. I thought some of the best, most forthright testimony we've had here came from Judge Ellis, who says, if you're going to give me anything, give me staff. So your words aren't following on deaf ears.
Anyway, any questions for Judge Kramer?
Yeah. Like to make a comment. Judge Kramer is an old friend. Went to school with my son, and his father was the herd of Kramer Hall at Portland State. That was his grandfather. And he had been at Harvard, I believe, for 1 year or so. And
it's
this year.
It's a much more interesting story if they kick you out now.
Well, I'm proud of you, Jeff. And that's what I'm saying. It's nice to see him there. He's one of the success stories of Arnie County.
And we won't hold it against you that you know Senator Jackson.
I hope not.
Any further questions? Let's Gary. Frank?
Actually, Bill Jones.
Bill Jones?
McKellar Morrow.
Okay.
Trial court administrator there recently.
Oh, yep.
From county counsel's office before. So I thought the perspective not only on their size court, but was also just having come from county counsel's office and staffing to generate kind of one piece of evidence to the courts and what happened when he walked in and saw what he had to work with. Nice people that they are.
Representative Wesson, members of the committee, Bill Jones, trial court administrator for Umatilla and Morrow counties. I am the new person on the block. I've been in my job 6 months, but prior to that I was Umatilla County Council for 5.5 years. So I think I know what is and isn't getting done in Northeast Oregon. In our judicial district, we run five courts over the distance of three cities, three in Pendleton, one in Hermiston, one in Heppner, with four judges and a total staff of 25 in certain days. The staff in the Heppner court is 1.4 FTE. When I took this job, it was 1 FTE. I transferred the 0.4 FTE over there so that we wouldn't have to close that court when the regular employee was ill or on vacation. We run the Hermiston court, which again is another full-service court, with 5 FTE. And the remainder of the FTE are with the three Pendleton courts where I'm located. back in the early 80s, the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute was built to handle 350 inmates. It now has 1,600 inmates, 160 of which are women. This past year, Unicole County built a new jail, funded with bond money, and they increased their jail capacity from 70 to 250 inmates. When Two Rivers Prison in Umatilla is complete this year, that will add another 1,600 inmates to our judicial district. So right now, we're talking about 3,400 inmates in our area. I can tell you I send a judge once a week to the OCI, Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute. When Two Rivers comes up, I can almost guarantee I'll be sending a judge a week over there. And we're trying to do things with video conferencing. There's an experiment going on right now between Unicel County, my presiding judge's courtroom, and EOCI to do these cases by video conferencing so you don't have to send the judge and the staff over there. But I can tell you, it still takes the same amount of time. You just don't have to send them over there. I don't know whether you're aware about the growth in the Hermiston area recently, but Hermiston per capita may be the fastest growing city in the state because of all the economic development over there. I could easily use another judge with the 5 FTE that comes with that judge just in the Hermiston area. The truth is, if we get another judge, that judge is probably going to have to be seated in Heppner because that's the only place where we have a place to put them. I guess I would just sort of summarize by saying we're doing everything we can with technology. We're doing everything we can with video conferencing. I've got video conferencing machines in four of the five courts, two in the new jail courtroom, one in the DA's office, and one for the grand jury. It saves a lot of time. We're doing 80 to 100 hearings a week, primarily arraignments, pretrials, probation violations, with video. It saves a lot of time, but you still have to have staff. The judge still has to have a judicial assistant. You still have to have a court reporter, and you still got to have people to process the paperwork, quite frankly. You save time with the video conferencing in terms of travel and that sort of thing, but you still have to process the case. I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Any questions for Mr. Jones? What's
in the next? Well, one of the things we need to remember, if I analogize this to the Legislative Assembly, there's 60 members of the House of Representatives. At some point, you can add just so many staff, you can add just so much of the support network. You still have to have that representative there. That's the person who has to make the decisions, has to be on the floor to vote. Or sometimes we could say the same as being in committees. Sometimes they have to run back and forth to be in and out of committee. At some point, you just run out of that, and you've reached that limit where it's not just the staff, it's the judicial position that you're talking about, the decision maker.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. Both in your case. In some cases, we've heard in certain areas, staff and technology are inadequate and can help make up for some other deficits. In this instance, we're talking both, especially the decision maker.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Moving into the valley and to the mid-sized course, I have now Judge Paul Lipscomb, who's presiding judge in Marion County.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Paul Lipscomb. I'm presiding judge in Marion County. And I'm going to try and keep this brief because I know we're all running over. The most recent study that I've heard of goes back to the early 80s, where it projected that an appropriate or desired level of staffing would be something in the nature of 7.5 or 8.5 for general jurisdiction courts, such as the Circuit Courts of Oregon. Our court, the statewide average in Oregon is 7.0. Our court is right at that 7.0. mark right now, but we've been sliding backwards ever since the state took over. And the reason for that is when we get additional judicial positions, we don't get seven staff with the judicial position. We only get 5.3 or 5.4, and with referees lately, we've been lucky to get one position with a judicial officer. The need is there, not just for judges, which is a true and growing need, but for staff also. Jim Murchison is here, our trial court administrator, and he has a handout that I'm going to refer to. Jim, if you could give that to the committee, that would be helpful to me. We have 16 judicial officers in Marion County, 13 judges, and 3 hearings referees. Those 16 judicial officers work out of 14 courtrooms. We have 6 stenographic court reporters to spread around. We have, as a consequence, equipped every courtroom for electronic recording of some sort, 4 for video and 10 for audio. It takes people to run the video and the audio also, however, just lower level, cheaper personnel. We play musical chairs with the judges. We play musical chairs with court reporters and with clerks to run the electronic equipment even. We have a full-time staff person that we've had to assign to the duty of coordinating all this because it's a workload change on a day-to-day basis. As cases settle, we prioritize which cases get the court reporters, which get the clerks, and it's a constant flux that shifts throughout the day. Is kind of an interesting aside, and it's fairly unusual story, but it happened months ago, and I only learned about it last week. We're so short staffed when everything goes for clerical personnel from time to time when something needs to be put on the record, there's not always somebody there and available to do that, and we have to do something fairly dramatic to pull somebody from somewhere. Judge Dickey and Judge Ochoa share staff support in the central area. And Judge Dickey's staff had gone somewhere else to take care of somebody else's problems, as had Judge Ochoa. Judge Dickey was doing the settlement conference. They concluded that they were ready to put the settlement on the record. There were no staff available to run the recording equipment to make the record. Judge Ochoa, one day per week, works on habeas corpus cases and runs our habeas corpus calendar and was working in his chambers doing that. Judge Ochoa volunteered to go into Judge Dickey's courtroom and run the court, the tape machine in order to get that settlement on the record. That doesn't happen often. That's very unusual. I just thought it was sort of a cute story that kind of dramatized the point to some extent. Because we're always shuffling around, whenever somebody has to be moved or we lose somebody, oftentimes that results in three or four, sometimes as many as five or six staff people being reassigned from one department to another, so we're coordinating abilities with work that needs to be done and positions that can be filled. So we're playing leapfrog with staff all the time. It's really difficult to have enough time to train new staff because there just aren't extra staff to free up to spend any significant block of time training new staff, so that when we get new staff on board, we get, honestly, an embarrassingly minimal amount of training. Not really what is appropriate to bring them up to level to make them efficient and to teach them to take full advantage of the technology and equipment that we have available. This becomes a true crisis when the flu strikes or August vacation time comes around. Last August, when we did have a lot of people out on vacation, we had high school work-study students who were working on work-study programs running our court records department for a couple of days at a time from time to time. I'm not here just telling a cry of war. What I want you folks to realize is that we're very thin. I think the courts throughout the state, Harney County, certainly that sounded particularly thin, but in our county, and I think every county, including Multnomah County, as Judge Ellis told you, we're very thin on staff. And you've heard about all the wonderful programs that courts across the state have been working hard to implement. We are trying to do more with less. We are trying to increase our level of public service, to become more user-friendly, to engage in more customer service kinds of activities. But all that stuff takes staff. Representative Patrick, you were talking about what can we do about the traffic cases? How can we better move the traffic cases? We have violations bureaus in our county and in many counties, but the violation bureau takes staff, frees up some judge time, and shrinks the rate of growth of adding new judges. But again, we need staff to run the violations bureau so that we can free up some additional judge time so that we're not always adding judges every session in counties the size of ours and larger. The Domestic Relations Resource Center, the Courthouse Facilitator Program that I was sure to talk to you folks about last time, it's a great program. We serve hundreds of people in that program in Marion County every month, but it takes staff to run it, and we don't have the extra staff to do it. What we did was steal staff from our law clerks program. We don't have law clerks in Marion County. We gave them up because we felt this was a very important program that we couldn't ignore any longer because of the volume of pro se litigants that weren't being served. But as a consequence, we don't have the law clerks. Mediation programs. We mediate small claims and FED cases. We have, I asked our mediation coordinator before I came over here. We have 25 volunteers that come in and assist us in mediating these small claims cases and FED cases in our courthouse, and they're there every day. Well, it takes somebody to coordinate that and get the right number of people to the court at that right time, get the bodies to the jury room, which is where these typically are held, and point people in the right direction. All that stuff takes staff. We have an arbitration coordinator. We have 1,500 cases in arbitration, 1,500 to 1,700 cases in arbitration at any one time. Somebody has to keep track of those as they go in and as they come out and monitor their progress so that they don't languish in arbitration because the attorney stopped paying attention to them. Drug courts, family courts, all these things take additional staff. We just don't have the resources to do that. And I guess that's my pitch to you. Yes, we need judges. and we can't continue to function without judges, but we need the staff to accompany them also, particularly if you want us to continue to try and raise our level of customer service to the community.
Representative Nance. Judge, I'd like to throw something out. You may want to think about this. But I've talked before with some government officials about the desirability of bringing some retirees back into government service, and their only compensation for working part-time would be paying their health insurance. That's the one benefit they pay out of their own pockets when they're retired. And setting up a system where if they work, say, depends on, there'd have to be a scheme set up, but a certain number of hours on average per year that their health insurance would be paid, and you could even bank hours towards future health insurance payments, and work perhaps half-time, a certain amount of time, or quarter-time, recognizing that that would involve a lot of coordination, and you'd probably have to hire a couple of people just to coordinate it. It occurs to me that Salem, being the capital city, there's a large number of retired government employees in this community. What would the notion of a pilot program, a test program, seem like if we said to the Marion County Circuit Court, we're going to try to see if we can make an efficient system out of providing health insurance benefits to government retirees who will come in, maybe preferably people who are retired from the court system, but perhaps even others. Granted, you lose efficiency at some point because people have got to be in enough time to get the job done, but to supplement certain positions, see if we can make reasonably efficient use of these folks, give them the benefit of having their health insurance paid, but give us the benefit of their service. Is this something that is worth exploring on a pilot program basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maggs, Marion County is, I think, a deserved reputation as a creative and innovative court. I'd certainly be eager for an opportunity to discuss that or any other measure that you could feel like you could afford to fund. My mother taught me long ago that half a loaf is better than none. Our need is critical, and I'm eager to look at any kind of solution that anyone feels might be helpful.
So you don't dismiss Representative Nance's idea?
I'd be eager to explore it with him.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to drag us off on the side of I talked to retirees about this concept, and by the way, also judicial retirees, if they want to put in some extra hours in order to get their health insurance paid, then you could have some judges coming in who are senior judges who've already done their service under their Plan B retirement. Get some extra hours. I know at some point this gets ridiculous. I understand that. This can only be a supplement, not a substitute, because you can't have part-timers doing all the work. But in a certain number of job categories, you might determine, this is why I talk about a pilot program, that you could efficiently use half-timers who have already experienced trained people, and they know that they're in the discipline of the job, but they can be dismissed from this opportunity. If they're not working out, that's the way it goes. They can go back to paying their health insurance. The beauty is that we're already paying. We have a system set up where
it's not taxable. And I brought it up with Mr. Junker, and I haven't heard further from the Department of Administrative Services. But it occurred to me today that maybe the judicial branch, rather than the executive branch, is where we ought to talk about this as a pilot program, since they're the folks who are the most in need of some help. And this should not be used as us as an excuse for not addressing other needs, but it might be a way of supplementing beyond that and testing out the notion in a friendly environment.
Representative Schrader, and then we'll call it a day. The staffing you're talking about here, though, is general courtroom staffing. I was a little confused with some of the testimony. I've heard that's where the greater need is as opposed to individuals to serve a particular judge. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I don't think that is correct. I think what we're talking about is Policy Package 101, and I don't know where that is in your material, but it's hard to read.
Looks like it's a combination a little bit there, is my read of that document.
what we're looking for in Marion County, and I think what I've been asked to do is present sort of an overview rather than focusing on our county particularly, but the first two judicial clerks, those are our law clerk positions. Those are the individuals that we took out of our existing funding to create the Dissolution Resource Service, the courthouse facilitation program that we're currently running. We need to expand that. We need to expand the ADR program. We need to expand the arbitration program. So what we're looking at is two judicial clerks, five clerk two, and one clerk three position to expand those enhanced customer service kinds of activities. These are not for courtroom staff. These are not for, other than the two law clerks, to serve 16 or hopefully 17 judicial officers. Those aren't services to judges or services to assist judges. These are services to assist the public and people who are coming in and volunteering to help us with our workload. Does that respond to your question?
Sure. I guess I'm not sure I'm where you are in terms of the need, but based on other conversations I've had with other individuals.
I don't know what those conversations are, and I don't know how I can respond to that.
And neither do I.
So, Kingsley, in regards to drug courts, I was going to talk to somebody and I didn't get back, so that was over in that presentation. But we have currently counties provide drug assistance. The Oregon Health Plan now provides drug assistance. We have courts. And it seems to me that if we could get some idea of that relationship and how that happens, and I understand, I think we've done a lousy job in alcohol and drugs in the state of Oregon. At the same token, we do provide those other services, and I'm interested in how they connect to the software. And evidently, you are using Oregon Health Plan.
Great chart. We will continue on Wednesday and take right off with the renovated purposes of Kingsley. If some people came from a distance or whatever and they want to come back, I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, if they want to come back, great. If they don't want to come back, we can do it in a day, fine. I think there's plenty of people in the building that's qualified to talk about facilities.
And Chair Wesley, these were the one-time costs of some things, not the long-term facility costs, and I just come up here.
Great. We are adjourned.